And I thought that entrepreneurs were like Johan Stolfen Holstein or Richard Branson. You know, they're on stage and they're speaking and they're strong leaders and they have a clear vision only they can see. And that was true as well. But there were many other types of entrepreneurs. So I found six of them. And these are caricatures, but I kept on coming across them so many times, so they became pretty clear for me. Realities entrepreneurs have mixes of all of these, but there's usually a dominant side. And you will probably recognize that when you think about your friends that are entrepreneurs or about yourself.
Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome to another episode of Future Skills. This is Ludvig Sundström, and together with Mikael Syding, I host Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. In this expert episode, we have serial entrepreneur Ola Alvarsson with us back on the show to tell us how to create successful innovation labs and to explain his framework of the five entrepreneurs. But before that, here's a little bit about Ola. Ola has founded more than 20 businesses and worked with many of the world's biggest brands, like McDonald's, Google, Microsoft, Twitter, and a lot more. He also has a black belt in karate and has become the world champion in kickboxing, and the European champion in Goryeo karate, and the Swedish champion in kung fu and taekwondo. Two notable businesses that Ola runs are Star Stable, which is the world's largest horse game with more than 6 million users, and Epicenter, which is Sweden's biggest scale-up incubator. This expert episode is divided up in two parts. In the first part, we learn how companies can run successful innovation labs, and Ola says that successful innovation labs are separate, shared, seen, slim, strategic, and have a clear structure. Then we learn about the five entrepreneurial types and how to build a team around them. And these five types are the virtuoso, the all-or-nothing entrepreneur, the better-safe-than-sorry entrepreneur, the serial entrepreneur, and the quote-unquote Mr. Sleeves-down entrepreneur. So let's begin now. What I want to ask you first here is, you've thought of at least six different parameters for innovating in the digital area. Could you explain about these and maybe some other models that inform how you think about this?
No, but we have worked with digital innovation as entrepreneurs, as intrapreneurs, and together with both large and smaller fast-growing companies for many years. And there's certain things that I think a lot of people get wrong, and I hope and think that we're getting it right almost all the time. And I think that innovation comes, it starts with a combination of mindset development and technology development. So if you just have a lot of technical platforms and technical or digital opportunities, but you cannot combine them with a mindset of learning, of changing, of other things that is important from a mindset perspective, nothing happens. And the same thing goes if you just go to a lot of inspiring events and you do a lot of soul searching and you're very digital in your lingo, but then you do everything on paper or in Excel and nothing comes out of it. So the two-pronged approach of mindset change and technology development, that's a good starting point. When you then look at what is needed in order for this to get buoyancy and to sort of to start picking up scale, you see a combination of mindset, technology, and business model.
Okay.
Because if these things aren't making financial sense, either top line or bottom line, which is often the case, they're just hyped up examples of things and people lose interest and then you go back to business as usual.
Right, so you need all three puzzle pieces working in unison.
Absolutely. So if you're a taxi company and just get an app instead of receiving a phone call, not super exciting. If you change the business model like Uber, super exciting. And I think in the business model dimension, a lot of companies don't take it all the way. So if you want to drive innovation, you need to also make sure that you challenge and reinvent whatever business model is the industry standard. So those are very interesting things. And we do that in our innovation labs. So we believe that there's certain things that needs to be in place. We break out a lab, so it's outside the immune system of the large company. And their employees or partnerships with external entrepreneurs or startups can happen at very high clock speed and with very different rules. So we believe it should be separate. So separate from the immune system with completely different rules. It should be shared. So many times people say, oh, this is the innovation department, or this is the Google X. We do the smart things here. The others don't get it. And they alienate everybody who's innovative in the company. That's wrong. It should be shared. Think of it like a summer house that anybody can go to, can dream about, can talk about, can brag about, and be part of. But you don't move to the summer house. And there are different rules in the summer house than in your normal house.
So it becomes kind of like a reward.
It could be a reward, or it could be a destination, or it could be somewhere you call when you need help in finding something really fast moving and innovative. But it's a summer house. So it's separate. It's shared. It's seen. Things that come out of there should be something everybody becomes proud of, and that is broadcasted widely. So you can use that to recruit new crazy people. You can use that to sort of create entrepreneurs and champions internally.
Making something both shared and separate, I see some difficulties with that.
Now think about the summer house. It's a shared summer house, but it's separate from your ordinary building.
And in terms of, for example, let's take Google.
Yep.
They have their famous idea of 1 day a week of working on whatever project you like. That's the innovative part. Mm-hmm. And since it's done by everybody, I can see how that's shared and separate. Well, kind of separate, but is it really?
No, but think of it almost like a corporate university where you can go to because you are handpicked because you're interesting and interested. The same thing is in an innovation lab. You go there to build something for a short period of time and you're championing that idea, but you're also championing everybody else. But you're not doing that because everybody else is boring or not doing their job. You're doing that to create more value for everybody in the company. And that works really well.
Could you come up with a tangible example?
So we run labs for the finance industry with SCB, for the telecom industry with Telenor. We run labs with Google. We run labs with Merck in digital health and so forth. And it works in all of these industries. So they go to Epicenter. There's a completely different clock speed. Their KPIs are different. Their challenge as entrepreneurs and startups are. We have a funny thing we do with Energy Curve, where all the teams tell us how much they hate or love their idea throughout the process. And they hate their idea, all of them. And then they love it and think it's going to change the world.
Without mentioning any particular bank, would you say that your clients that come to Epicenter from, for example, the banking industry, that they are they faster or slower than the typical standalone fintech company?
I mean, if you're 20,000 people, different rules apply, right? Or if you run nuclear power plants, you can't just be a little bit experimental at the same time. So different industries have different boundary conditions. But I mean, we've had a couple of thousand people from the banking industry that think and work differently than they did before they went to the lab. And we have numerous ideas coming out. But I'll just take you through, because there's a couple of S's more. There should be S's as well, like seen, shared, separate. It should be slim. If it costs too much to build these kind of things, it becomes innovation theater and it gets axed by the CFO the first time they have a chance. So 7 out of 10 labs don't survive the first year if they're done in-house. And then it needs to be strategic. It needs to be anchored around things that are super important for someone. Otherwise, it's just done to look good and that's not good enough. And then it needs to be structured based on proven methodologies, driving towards sort of things that actually work. And when we look at most other labs or things like that, they say the same things. It's like if Reykjavik, that's a bad example, Iceland are good at football now, but if Dubrovnik in Barcelona said the same things about football, they use exactly the same words, and then they expected to be as good as Barcelona, forgetting the history of Barcelona as a football city, the players that are recruited there, the money in it, and the other things. And so there's so much innovation bullshit going around, and it doesn't turn into anything.
To begin with, my brother was actually part of one of your innovation labs, mm-hmm. from a bank. Mm-hmm. And he said it was really good and he was really happy with the experience. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, nice to hear.
Yeah. And then now when you say that the project has to be anchored around one person, or at least it has to be really important for one person.
Not necessarily for one person, it needs to be important. So for instance, it's so easy to come up with ideas for the sake of the ideas, right? Wouldn't it be cool to be the first bank on the moon? Yeah, everybody thinks that's cool, right? Do you want that in your KPIs? Do you want to bet your career on the bank on the moon? Probably not, right? Mm-hmm. So nothing comes out of it. Or in order to be safe, you take up the interest rate a little bit and you make more money. Oh, you made money. But that's not innovation, right? So where do you find the type of innovation you're looking for? And most people have a vague view. They need to be more innovative. They need to be more digital, but they're not driving towards very clear goals. And hence, they don't know if they succeed or not. And when you go into the lab, the same day, you talk to customers. So you can scrap the idea the day after and go back to the bank, to the telco or somewhere else. Or for instance, if we work with Merck, that are leaders in MS, we try things on real MS patients, same week. And it's not about the pill that takes 17 years to develop. It's about whatever else happens when you get MS that we can help you with or facilitate or give you information or give out better training advice or better food advice or what could be around the pill that we could explore with very, very rapid prototyping models.
That was the first segment of this expert episode. And as a brief recap, what Ola said is that 7 out of 10 of these innovation labs typically fail. And that's because they don't follow the specific methodology. They're not separate, shared, seen, slim, strategic, and have a coherent structure. Now, in this next part, we ask Ola about the 5 entrepreneurial types, what they are and how he came up with them. And this is originally from his book, Mission Possible. So let's hear what he has to say here.
No, but I set out to write a book many years ago about entrepreneurs because when the dot-com crash happened, $5 trillion evaporated in 6 months. There were people sitting with signs on the street, "We'll code for food." And all of the things we believed in, like internet advertising, communities, video online, all these kinds, e-commerce, it was just seen as bullshit. So I said, okay, has this happened before? What have happened in other crises? So I started looking at crises and I started looking at entrepreneurs. And then that led to writing a book about entrepreneurs called Mission Possible. And I thought that entrepreneurs were like Johan Stahl von Holstein or Richard Branson. You know, they're on stage and they're speaking and they're strong leaders and they have a clear vision only they can see. And that was true as well. But there were many other types of entrepreneurs. So I found 6 of them and I'll just drop them really fast. The first one is what I call the all or nothing entrepreneurs. The guys that build something that only they can see and they keep on doing it against the odds and they never think about risk. Tetra Pak, for instance, with Ruben Rao Singh, they were losing money for 14 years until they became the profitable, most profitable company in Europe and he became one of the richest people. Every time they were going bankrupt, he bought the other guy's shares and said, "You don't have to live through that." And they said, "Oh, they don't have any imagination." And then he just kept on going. Columbus, there might be land, let's sail, guys. So for everyone that succeeds of these guys, there are thousands of them that don't succeed. So it's very difficult to back these guys, but they're the most successful entrepreneurs.
There are a lot of Vikings who actually found the waterfall at the edge of the world.
Yeah. The second type is what I call the serial entrepreneur. That's the most common one. The Richard Branson, the one that always comes up with a new idea. Donald Duck, right? And with them, you have to be sure that you're with them during the idea that actually makes the money or makes the success or makes something useful. And you got to pin them to the idea so they don't go away and start the next one. The third one is what I call the virtuosi. I've always been jealous of them. It's like my wife. She's a very good designer. And now she sells in 160 stores and everywhere. And it's just growing because she's good at design. So if I ask her about what's your market analysis for Germany, he says, "Well, I like the way the pattern flows over the hip." It's a completely different conversation. Then she understands business too, but her starting point is being really good at something.
What's her name again? Because every girl I talk to, their eyes just glaze over I mention her.
The brand is called Alvar Gallery and she's Frida Alvarsson. But it's super, alvar.com if you want to check it out. But it's funny because if you're Erik Lallestad, all of a sudden you already have restaurants. You probably didn't start and say, "I'm going to build 6 restaurants, damn it. And I'm going to have sauces too, called Lallestad or Eric's." So that's the virtuoso. They're just super good at something. So if you work with them, keep things out of their way so they can be brilliant.
Is this like Jamie Oliver too?
Similar type, very similar. The fourth one is what I call the better safe than sorry entrepreneur. These are the best entrepreneurs in terms of if you want to invest in them. They're very seldom on the cover of the newspapers, but they make solid business. And it's just, they know a dollar is a dollar and a cent is a cent. Their overlord is Ingvar Kamprad. You know, when IKEA starts a new place, supposedly they buy all the land incognito and then they sell it to finance the IKEA because the land goes up when they publish that IKEA is going to launch. You know, you have a little pencil there because you don't need a bigger one.
Ray Kroc.
Yeah, Ray Kroc. Exactly that type of entrepreneur as well.
Actually, my partner in the e-surf business as well, the motorized surfboards, he's exactly like that.
Yeah, and I mean, they're super good. And Uncle Scrooge is like that. He's never going to need money, right? And then you have what I call the intrapreneur, the most important entrepreneur by factor 100. We should applaud these people. They usually get very little applaud and very often not any reward as all, no reward at all. They're the change makers in large companies, because when Caterpillar decides, oh, we're doing machines here, Caterpillar, and somebody says, can we make shoes too? Yeah, there's a lot of shoes being sold all over the world. So, or when Microsoft says, let's become a consumer portal, that would be fun. We're a software company, but now let's become a consumer portal.
Would you say that the intrapreneurs are the ones you're trying to accelerate with Epicenter?
Yes. Scale-ups and intrapreneurs. Entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs. And there, if you get them to use the full power of a large company and the full visionary thinking and methodology of a startup or a scale-up, magic happens. And that impacts millions of people. That's why I'm so fascinated about them.
How can a company identify its intrapreneurs?
By giving them the opportunity to pursue their ideas, regardless of where they are in a company. And they can do that at Epicenter, for instance. That's what we do a lot of. But the last one, it's the false entrepreneur. I call it Herr Doktor Sleevestown. Herr, because it's always a guy. Doctor, because they think titles are important. Sleeves down, because they're so far away they can from the business. They want to be a title. They don't want to do the work. So they're the false entrepreneurs. They're the ones that banks say, no, you can't get a loan. You didn't even finish school. Or what if Microsoft would do that? Or they're the ones that get super provoked by people who want to change the status quo. And they want to use their position that they somehow get to slow you down. And think of them as Homer Simpson. Oh, it's Herr Doktor Sleevestown. And then just navigate around them, because people like that will never build any companies, and they shouldn't stop you from building that either.
If we look at the, like, the reason that I like this model is because before I read about it, I had a really narrow and probably pretty bad definition of what it means to be an entrepreneur. Then when I read about this, I realized I could see this pattern in a lot of successful entrepreneurs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it made things more clear for me.
Yeah, and you start respecting people that you didn't see as entrepreneurs. Yeah. And when you make people think about them as entrepreneurs, even though they don't recognize themselves in Richard Branson, they start feeling they have an opportunity, maybe even a responsibility to create change and create. And if you unlock that entrepreneurship in a large company, wow, it's super cool what can come out of it.
So I think to sum up here, could you explain what kind of skill sets each of these entrepreneurs have or should develop?
I think it's very individualistic, and it's also contextual for the companies they're building. But I think it's about the teams you create around them. If you have somebody that's an all or nothing entrepreneur, you need to have a CFO that knows something about risk, knows something about taking mindful decisions rather than just believe in a psychosis, right? If you have a serial entrepreneur, you need to commit them so that they work long enough with something so that it has a chance of becoming successful. Not just getting more and more kids all the time. You need to be a parent as well to the things you create, right? If you're a virtuosis, it's about somebody that can do the business part of things so that you can do the creative and product and wonderful things that your virtuosis skills are just God-given to make. If you're an intrapreneur, you need a boss that allows you to play and develop and to not get sucked into the corporate machinery and thrown out because you don't fit in. So there's difference depending on who you are. And if you're a better safe than sorry entrepreneur, maybe you need somebody who's visionary on your side, or a great marketing director asking you for money to do crazier and crazier things. Because otherwise, some of these companies, they get sort of stuck in the middle. They become okay, but never super great.
I want to thank you for sharing this with us, and also for explaining this and putting it into context. Like, even if, first of all, you have to kind of figure out if one of these is for you, and you feel like you can identify with one of these, and then second, to find a complementary partner.
Yeah.
Or several.
Yeah.
Like first,
and they're
first,
just as valuable as you are.
Yeah. First, you kind of know yourself.
Yeah.
Figure that out, and then you figure out how to amplify that and build a team.
Yeah, and I mean, these things are caricatures, but I kept on coming across them so many times, so they became pretty clear for me. Realities entrepreneurs have mixes of all of these, but there's usually a dominant side, and you will probably recognize that when you think about your friends that are entrepreneurs or about yourself. And I think that also a last word is respect the first persons that joins an entrepreneurial team, because they are the ones that make the entrepreneur into a leader instead of an idiot with a plan that only they believe in.
Okay, thank you so much, Ola.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, I hope you enjoyed this expert episode with Ola Alvarsson. And be sure to subscribe to our newsletter, which you can find over at www.futureskillspodcast.com. And there's also a link in the description. And there we send the summary of every episode that we air with bullet points and all those kind of things. Nice stuff. All right. Thanks for listening and bye.